Hey, Better Leaders, it's Danny Sunshine Bauer, and I have a quick message I want to share with you. If you're not new to the show, if you're a longtime listener, you've heard me talk over and over again about Masterminds. It's a hybrid group coaching and leadership development community that I created specifically for school leaders. They are blowing up. They're going bananas right now, and they're so popular, I've actually opened a third group. What I want you to know is this. Starting May 6th, the membership is increasing. And so if you want to lock in the best deal, the best rate you'll ever get, you need to act now. If you have no idea what I'm talking about, head over to betterleadersbetterschools.com, type mastermind in the search box, and a bunch of podcast episodes as well as blog posts will pop up, and you can learn about the value of a mastermind. By now, if you're ready to join, then I want you to go to the website, betterleadersbetterschools.com/MM for mastermind. Lock in that rate because I'm telling you, May 6th, the membership increases. Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free year-round fundraising program for schools. You can learn more at schoolspiritvending.com.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
In today's show, I interview a blogging hero of mine, Eric Barker, and we talk about so many interesting things, the benefits of meditation, how stoicism can help you make better choices. Do you think enough about your thoughts? Because guess what? You can change those. Eric has a new book coming out called Barking Up the Wrong Tree. Encourage you to get it. Links in the show notes, and we're definitely going to be reading that in the mastermind. Are you a part of that? Why not? Email me if you're not, and I'll tell you a little bit more about it. Listen, I am not taking for granted that you are here today. Thank you for tuning in and enjoy the show. Hey there, Better Leaders. I am so excited today to connect with Eric Barker. He's been writing on the internet for quite a while, and I've been enjoying his blog posts and learning a lot from him. Eric's humorous practical blog, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, presents science-based answers and expert insights on how to be awesome at life. Over 290,000 people subscribe to his weekly newsletter. Eric, that's only 289,000 more than me, so good job. And his content syndicated by Time Magazine, The Week, and Business Insider. He's been featured in the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, The Atlantic Monthly, and the Financial Times. With a writing career spanning over 20 years, Eric's also a sought-after speaker and interview subject, and he's been invited to speak at MIT, Yale, West Point, University of Pennsylvania, NPR affiliates, and on morning television. His first book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree, will be released by HarperCollins on May 16th. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, man. I appreciate it.
So how would you describe your leadership style, Eric, and how did you develop this style?
It's really interesting because for most of the stuff I do on the blog, I always try to look at academic research or interview experts. And one of the most interesting pieces of research regarding leadership, which affected how I deal with people, is made a distinction between, we always think of extroverts as leaders and introverts maybe not so much. And the truth is that the research shows extroverts are more likely to be chosen as leaders, but it doesn't mean that they necessarily are better leaders. And it comes down to an issue of style. With a less proactive group, extroverts are far better leaders. This is research that was done by Adam Grant at Wharton and a number of his colleagues. And with extroverts, if they're dealing with a less proactive group, they're the superior leaders. But with a group that is very proactive, that's energized and assertive, introverts are actually better leaders because they know how to kind of step back, listen, get out of the way, provide, you know, just enough to keep things on target. And being more of an introvert myself, I found that I gravitated towards the latter. And just reading that research really helped me understand that I wasn't doing anything wrong. That if I'm with a group of people, leading a group of people who are very proactive themselves, who know what they want to do, who are energized, then it's actually okay for me to hang back and focus more on course correction than constantly trying to energize them, which they don't really need and which isn't generally my strong suit.
That's good too, because it gives you, you know, permission to be yourself as well. And having to flip that on switch to, I guess, motivate people and that sort of thing, to always be on, to be up in front, have high energy, that kind of stuff can be exhausting too.
Yeah, that's, you know, I prefer dealing with, I mean, you know, if people don't know necessarily what they're doing, then yeah, it's like you need to be up there and you need to be providing examples and you need to, you know, maybe almost micromanaging. But if you've got people who know what they're doing, who are good at what they do, you know, the last thing they want is somebody constantly looking over their shoulder. And so, you know, I just try to make sure just picking the right pond, you know, is a really key thing that I talk about in the book. And I just try to engineer situations where I know that my strengths are going to be utilized.
So you have a huge platform now, Eric. And we made that joke about the 290,000 subscribers. And the listeners, you know, these are school leaders, principals, APs, superintendents, teacher leaders as well. And they're very curious about influence. And so I'm also curious about what have you learned as your voice has been amplified through the web? What have you learned about influence? And what could you tell the folks listening today about stewarding that influence?
For me, what's really, really been interesting is I started out focusing very much on the research, on getting just the information that was beyond reproach and striving for legitimacy. And I think that was a very good move, because we all know that, you know, when you look on the internet, you never know where something's coming from, what the source is, or, you know, if this is awesome, you know, controlled study, or if this is some idea that somebody came up with over lunch. So that was originally, you know, my strong push. But one thing I found over time is that by complementing that with, you know, a personal touch, with warmth, with stories, with things that people connect with emotionally, balancing those two became a real strength. And I think that's something that's true in general, is that, you know, you do want to be providing legitimate information, stuff that people trust, that has been vetted. But on the flip side, you also don't want to come across as cold or mechanistic, or, you know, you want to make sure it's something people relate to, they connect with, that they enjoy. And I think that balance has really served me well.
You know, a lot of people complain about social media and how our lives are so interconnected with you know, new technologies, being online and so forth. But you're just touched on adding warmth, right, and emotion, compassion to your writing. So how do you do that when some folks are saying this is actually making us more distant?
You know, the technology is a tool. You can use it for different purposes. It can lead to great things in terms of connecting people with each other, connecting people with ideas. But on the flip side, it can also be a distraction, an addiction. So it depends on how it's used. And, you know, so for me, it's got to have that balance. It's funny because I spent a decade in Hollywood as a screenwriter, and I wrote for Disney and for Fox and a couple different things. So writing stuff that's entertaining has always been something that was important to me. And I think that's really critical, because I think there's a lot of situations where there's gray eye, or it's not clear, it's hard to read, and so people are missing out on really valuable stuff. You know, there's a great quote from William Gibson I love, where he said, the future is already here, it's just not evenly distributed. And, nice. You know, the answers are often out there, but if there's too much friction, if it's too difficult to get the information across, people are never going to learn it. So I think combining, valid, actionable, legitimate information with a warmth, a humanity, a compelling hook, good storytelling, that makes the medicine go down easier.
Absolutely. And yeah, that's something I've really admired about the blog too, is like it's filled just with so many actionable steps that you could implement today, you know, if you're action oriented and want to, and you could see direct results as well.
Absolutely. I mean, that's something I strive for.
So in terms of actionable advice, I'm curious, you know, what does the first hour of your day look like? Do you have any type of morning routine or ritual that helps you start off with a bang, so to speak?
Absolutely. I'm a big believer in morning rituals and, you know, morning routines. And I would say that in some ways, my morning routine starts before that morning. When I spoke to Tim Ferriss, the fantastic writer of the 4-Hour Workweek, one of the things he does when he finishes the prior day, at the end of the day, he writes out his goals for the next day. So they're already kind of percolating in the back of his head. They're there when he's sleeping. And then when he wakes up, you know, he's already ready to go. And, you know, that to me is critical. Another thing that happens before your morning routine is just getting enough sleep. You know, we hear so much about that, but, you know, the research is just beyond that. You know, getting enough sleep, waking up, feeling refreshed, not only does it put you in a much better mood, it just helps you be less reactive, where you're not waking up and you just feel like the world's already been going for an hour and you're playing catch up and you're just reacting to things. You can actually kind of say, hey, here are the goals I put forward. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's the order I'm going to do them in. And you have a layer of control that, you know, plenty of research shows buffers us against stress. So a big part of my morning routine happened before the morning, but once I start the morning, you know, what's critical for me is making sure just, you know, my head's on straight and that I know what my priority is. And so the real key there is, beyond getting enough, you just want to make sure your head's, you're in a good mood. What energizes you? What makes you feel good? Because there's actually some research from Wharton that shows your mood in the morning sets your mood for the rest of the day. And for a lot of people, unless something awesome happens, however high that peak is in the morning, you're not going to get much better than that unless, again, something outside. So you want to set your mood. You're in a good place. You know what energizes you. And then focusing on priorities. What's that one thing that I have to get done today where if everything else just completely does not work out, what's that one thing that if I get it done, I will have accomplished something, I'll have moved the needle, you know, I've moved things forward, and that kind of sets an idea in my head where no matter what happens, you know, I can judge it against that and say, if I only have a few hours left, what's this most important thing? Because otherwise, like I said, you end up reactive and you're just responding to stuff. And then we end up getting cycles of busy work instead of the things that in the long term are really going to move us forward.
So, Eric, if you don't mind me asking, what was your one thing today?
My one thing today was this podcast.
Whoa, so no way.
I sat down and was making sure that, you know, I reviewed the material and, you know, I've been so caught up in everything marketing the book. I wanted to make sure that I had some of my thoughts together and I knew what I was going to be talking about.
I appreciate that. Didn't see that coming, but I'll take it. Awesome. And sticking with the what gives you energy in life and kind of setting the tone for the day, what is that for you?
For me, actually, it's meditation. Just kind of, you know, taking a little bit of time. There's all different kinds of mindfulness practices, tons of research, you know, on that. And for me, it's kind of just step back because we, you know, sometimes, you know, you got a lot going on. That voice in your head is already chattering. And, you know, I want to make sure that I can take a step back from, you know, that chattering voice in my head and focus on what's important. And, you know, just a little bit of mindfulness meditation allows me to kind of disconnect from that voice, to step back, to realize what my priorities are, and to structure my day around my goals instead of letting my goals be determined by, you know, whatever random thing pops up in my email box or whatever, you know, somebody calls me with. I want to make sure that I know what's in that day, so it's front and center, and that everything gets ordered around that.
And is this something that I guess you have experience in doing? So you just are able to start focusing on your breath and that sort of thing? Is it an app you use, or what does your mindfulness practice look like?
I mean, basically, it's quite simple. A very good, very entertaining question to this would be Dan Harris's book, 10% Happier. Laugh out loud funny, but also a really good introduction to mindfulness meditation. And basically, it's just, you know, taking a second. You can be sitting in a chair, you can lay down, doesn't matter, closing your eyes and just focusing on your breath. Your mind will wander, return back to the breath, and just, you know, focusing on the breath. It just helps. You're never going to clear your mind. You know, that's a mistaken idea. You're never going to clear your mind, but return to the breath. And just over time, I've seen a big difference in the level of clarity and just being able to take a step back from the thoughts in your head and not taking them so seriously and realizing, you know, that whatever pops up, whether it's a concern, a worry, just being able to say, is this useful? And then being able to kind of let it go or to accept a difficult situation instead of getting tangled up in being concerned or worried about things that just aren't that important.
You know, and you brought up the question, is this useful? That question, along with four others, you mentioned in a really interesting article you published recently, five questions that will make you emotionally strong. That had, is this useful? Let's see here. We got, does the world owe me this? Must I have this to live a happy life? Is this who I want to be? And have I ever felt that way? I don't know that you could pick like a favorite question, or I'm curious, is there one of those questions or one of these ideas of anger or the idea of usefulness and worry? One of those you find that you struggle with the most, or is it just something that, you know, is constantly in your mind, and this type of, I guess, writing and putting this stuff out in public helps you work through your feelings, right? And ideas and live a little bit of a saner life.
I mean, it's funny you pick that post, because it's one that's actually very near and dear to my heart, because oftentimes I'll look at the research or a book, or I'll interview an expert, and, you know, I'm finding a way to translate and make that accessible to people so that they can use it. And then every now and then I'll round up a few of these so that when I've talked to multiple experts on a single topic, this post was a little different in the sense that the central five questions, these are things I use. These are the things that over time, from looking at a lot of the research, reading a lot of the books, talking to the experts, these are kind of my distillation. Those are five questions that I'm always asking myself. And then I back it up with the evidence, with the history, because these questions come everywhere from, you know, from neuroscience to social science research to Buddhist inspired mindfulness to ancient Stoicism. And these are the things that how I quickly kind of remind myself of a few of the things. And, you know, the is it useful question is really good when something's on your mind and it's bothering you and you kind of can't let go of it. You know, the is it useful question is really critical. That's a good one for me. And another one that's really big is the must I have this to live a happy life? And, you know, that originally was inspired by Marcus Aurelius, the Roman emperor and Stoic philosopher. And because I think we just get so attached to things sometimes, and, you know, it's almost like an obsession, and it's hysterical. It's one of these crazy things about the human mind where you get so wrapped up in something, you feel like if you don't have this, you're going to die, the world's going to end. And then, you know, the world doesn't end, but the next day, there's a new, oh my God, this is so important, oh, how am I going to do it, oh my God, I have to have this. And then it doesn't happen,
yeah.
The world doesn't end, you're fine, but that doesn't stop you from doing it again 2 hours, oh my God. You're able to take a step back and say, do I have to have this? And I underline this, because, you know, we need food, we need shelter, you know, we need oxygen, but this thing, whatever this thing is, do you have to have this to live a happy life? You know, is mm-hmm. the world's, you know, it's a cliche, but the world's not going to end. And to take a step back and remind yourself of that, because that clinging to those things we think we need just leads to so many bad decisions and just muddies our priorities and our goals. And to just take a step back and say, you know, do I have to have this to live a happy life?
It's such a good question. I mean, this is the type of stuff that I love to really think about. And especially, must I have this to live a happy life? What you were just talking about, I could connect with so well right now. Because my love, Miriam, she just accepted a position to work in Antwerp, Belgium, leading this global health program. She's an epidemiologist and is just going to do some really exciting stuff. But in the process of saying yes to go into Belgium, I'm looking around my condo, right? I was in Chicago last year. I'm in Houston this year. And Eric, I'm having to ditch it all. You know what I mean? Like, it's expensive to move.
Yeah.
And the TV, I love it. The 65-inch TV, right? That I barely watch, you know? That's not coming with me. I'm selling stuff that I've held near and dear to my heart for so long, like these board games or whatever. It's just stupid stuff. I sold my Apple Watch just because, one, I don't need I want to get all those converters, you know, for the plugs.
Yeah.
I probably could buy a different USB, but whatever. And I asked myself, do I really need this, right? And the constant buzzing and notifications on my wrist too. I'm like, this is kind of more of a pain than it is useful, so I'm going to sell it. But at first, it really, really hurt. Must I have this to have a happy life? But now it's almost like a game, like how much of it can I get rid of before we move? Or then, I guess, just give away for free. So So listeners, if you live in the Houston area and you're trying to pick up some stuff, don't wait, buy it first. I don't, but it might be going for free too. So you're so right with that.
No, I totally agree with you because I think it's a bad habit we get into. And once we realize, and that's the Marcus Aurelius quote is, very little is needed to make a happy life. It is all within yourself and your way of thinking. And when you look back, it's like, how many different things did you think I have to have? I'm going to die if I don't get this promotion. And, you know, and a couple of years later, you don't even work there anymore. And you don't even think about it.
Right.
And, you know, it's and how much stuff that you had to buy. And you know, it's just distractions from the things that are really important.
You know, and you talked about mindfulness and stoicism within that blog post. And you mentioned Tim Ferriss, who's really into those. I'm curious, have you read The Obstacle's the Way and Ego's the Enemy?
Ryan Holiday's a friend of mine, and he's...
No way.
Yeah, he actually, he blurbed my book, and Ryan is fantastic, and, you know, he's how I first got into Stoicism, and I interviewed him about it, and I was lucky enough to get an early copy of Daily Stoic, and I should have mentioned it earlier, I actually read a passage from that every day as part of my morning ritual, because, you know, that's what's so interesting is... like I said, I look at the academic research, I talk to experts. So some people might say, well, you know, it's like Buddhism is a religion, Stoicism is a philosophy, what is it? But the truth is, what a lot of people don't realize is that, you know, a lot of Buddhist practices like mindfulness meditation, compassion meditation have had enormous amount of academic literature has been posted on the benefits of meditation. And Stoicism was actually the inspiration that Albert Ellis and others used for creating what is now basically the most powerful form of therapy, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, finds, you know, a good portion of its origins in Stoicism. So both of these are backed by science. And, you know, like I said, I wouldn't really have stumbled upon Stoicism if it wasn't for Ryan.
How would you sum Stoicism up for listeners that they may not have heard about that yet?
Stoicism's really interesting because it's a cobbling together of a lot of different ideas from a number of different thinkers. But some of the critical ideas, things, or we get angry, you know, when things don't go our way. And if you realize that a lot of things are outside your control, you don't have to get angry. You don't have to get frustrated. The only thing you can completely control is your choices. And to focus on those, to focus on what is within your control, to not get disturbed by what is not in your control. A big part of what we have to realize is that, and this is another critical part of Stoicism, is that, you know, it's really our impressions, not actual events, that lead to us being, you know, unhappy or angry or sad. You know, what is valuable to you might not be valuable to me. So it's that. It's what value do you give to this? It's that impression in your head. You know, if I told you I was going to give you a green rectangle, you might not be very impressed by that. But if that green rectangle was a $100 bill,
we
ascribe great value to those green rectangles. But if you were to give a $100 bill, and this is an analogy I'm taking from Yuval Noah Harari, who wrote the excellent book Sapiens. If you gave a monkey a $100 bill, they wouldn't care. They can't eat it. They can't use it. It's not useful to them. But we all believe in this collective fiction that green rectangle is worth something. And as long as other people believe it's worth something, then it is worth something. So the green rectangle in itself is not a big deal. But, you know, when you ascribe it that value, that's what causes the emotional response of you getting happy or unhappy or sad or worried. You know, if you perceive something as a threat, you get scared. If you perceive it as a challenge, well, hey, you know, then now it's not so scary. It's an opportunity for you to test yourself, you know, in the same way that, you know, I mean, you were talking about, you know, that it was very stressful at first for you to try and get rid of all this stuff to prepare for your move. You said, well, I started to look at it as a game. And then all of a sudden you were framing it in a different way. You're putting it in a different context. And that, I'm sure, completely changed rather than, oh my God, I love these things so much and now I'm getting rid of them. It's awful. It's terrible. As opposed to, okay, now I'm having fun. It's a game. So it's not about the things. It's about the impressions, the ideas, the thoughts that you ascribe to those things. And you can change those thoughts a lot easier than you can change physical matter and the world. So we should think about, you know, those thoughts and those values more than we think about, you know, a world which doesn't always care so much about how much we like what's going on.
I like that. It's almost, do we think enough about our thoughts that we could change them? That's really what we have power and authority, I guess, over, and drastically changes our experience of the day. Like you said, with my experience, framing it from, I got so much stuff to get rid of, how am I going to do it, to, this is now a game, this is fun, you know, how much can I get rid of by this date? So
that specifically, very specifically, it's funny you said that, because for the blog, I've interviewed a Navy SEAL on grit. I've interviewed a Army Ranger on leadership, a Special Forces officer, and it was really funny that all three of them, they don't know each other, yet they all talked about that game frame. And it's something I discuss in the book as being critical to grit and resilience. But that framing it as a game, all of them independently used that method to help them get through, you know, that insanely rigorous training, which most people do not make it through. Rather than saying, oh my God, you know, I'm going to be awake for 3 days straight. Oh my God, I'm only getting one meal a day. You know, this is torture. It's a game. And once they framed it as a game, they couldn't change what they had to do, but they changed right. The way they saw it. All of them credited that with getting them through some of the most rigorous training there is.
Today's show is brought to you by School Spirit Vending. School Spirit Vending has a hassle-free year-round fundraising program for schools. And believe it or not, their CEO and founder, Matt Miller, was a guest on episode 5 of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. He can increase your school spirit with custom stickers for your school and raise funds at the same time. There's no upfront costs, no volunteers, no selling. It's absolutely free to you, the school. If you're sick of the same old ways of raising money, check out School Spirit Vending at schoolspiritvending.com. So Eric, you know, I've asked a lot of questions I'm interested in, but listen, this show is about you. You're the hero. Tell us the story about starting your blog, and you got a new book coming out. Tell us all about that, please.
The blog actually started, it was really interesting. When I was getting my MBA and I was taking a really interesting class on negotiation and I was introduced to social science. I had been a philosophy major undergrad at the University of Pennsylvania, and I was always interested in the big questions, but, you know, philosophers are usually, I mean, most of this stuff's hundreds of years old, if not thousands, and they didn't have a lot of proof or evidence. So when I discovered social science, it was asking big questions, and it was actually providing, you know, scientifically validated answers. So I immediately gravitated towards it, and that kind of opened a new world for me. And I just started reading this stuff. I just started reading more and more abstracts. I started reading more scientific papers. And I'm like finding, kind of like that William Gibson quote, you know, on the future not being evenly distributed, I started to realize that questions we have all wondered about, you know, there are answers. It's just most people don't, you know, trawl through these journals to find them. So I just started posting the things I'd find. And very quickly, people gravitated towards this because it was a quick and easy way to, you know, get things that we were all kind of curious about. And I was very lucky. Tyler Cowen, a phenomenal blogger and a professor at George Mason University, started mentioning my blog all the time, and it started growing. And then Business Insider started syndicating, and Time Magazine started syndicating, and the subscriber number of people subscribing and reading just grew and grew and grew. And I started seeing patterns and trends in different subjects. And then I started, you know, collecting different studies, rounding them up, putting them together, trying to pull insights and kind of bigger answers that we could get from different papers. And, you know, after what I started the blog in 2009, and then by 2014, you know, so many friends and readers were just saying, you got to write a book, you got to write a book. And I was trying to, you know, rack in my brain. And I just realized from finding all these answers in research and talking to experts that I wanted to get to some of the fundamental questions about success in life, because we all grow up with these maxims, you know, where it's nice guys finish last. It's not what you know, it's who you know. Quitters never win, winners never quit. And are those even true? We don't know. We just hear them. And so basically what I decided to do with the book was sort of give these maxims that we've all heard and that we don't know the veracity of, and kind of give them the Mythbusters treatment. And so each chapter in the book I take one of those maxims and I look at the research and I give it its day in court. And, you know, is it what you know? Okay, well, let's look at that. All right, is it who you know? Let's look at that. And then try to find out, are these statements true, or when are they true, in what context are they true? And then trying to come up with what is the real takeaway here in terms of the subjects of, you know, grit and resilience, networking versus expertise, living an ethical life while still trying to get ahead, and to come to sort of new maxims that that are scientifically validated that we can live by, that we know will work.
So I'm curious too. I mean, you know, the audience is school leaders, and it sounds like to me, I'm going to make an assumption and then, you know, rip it up if it's wrong. But for the audience, this would be a great book to get, because probably a lot of these maxims you were talking about might be perceptions that guide our lives and our leadership. And knowing if they're right or wrong could be very impactful and powerful in our leadership practice in terms of our impact that we have every day serving students and working with our communities.
Absolutely. The first chapter of the book is all about basically, should we, you know, playing by the rules? You know, it's the kind of question of, you know, is it just drink your milk, eat your Wheaties, get good grades, do what mom says? Is that the path to success?
Hope the answer is no, because I hate that. I hate it.
Exactly, because on one hand, you know, we all know somebody who was valedictorian and played all the sports, led all the groups, and, you know, went to good schools and did very well. But on the flip side, you know, we all know the story. You know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, they're all college dropouts. And, you know, and these are guys who went on to become billionaires and found, you know, companies that every person has heard of and probably interacts with on a daily basis. So, you know, for me personally, I'm not writing this as some sort of abstract exercise. I want these answers as much as anybody else. And, you know, I've struggled in terms of, you know, career-wise, you know, what is the right path? And so starting to ask these questions and addressing many of the sort of things that you and your audience are interested in terms of, you know, leadership, influence, you know, getting ahead. These are the kind of things, you know, I want to know about. So this was not some exercise on my part. I wanted these answers as much as anybody else.
Yeah, it's super interesting. You know, listeners, I group coach 21 school leaders, principals, APs, instructional coaches, even a superintendent in my mastermind, which I call Hybrid Group Coaching Leadership Development Community. But this is the type of book that we read in our group. And I'm gonna say we're going to get Barking Up the Wrong Tree, and we are going to dig through it as a group and talk about it. We do one book a month, so we'll do that. So listener, if you're in the mastermind, don't get it. I'm getting it for you. But if you're a listener not in the mastermind, either join and you can read it with us, or definitely buy the book. Better Leaders, you know that all this great stuff. So like the 5 questions that make you emotionally strong, or Barking Up the Wrong Tree, the book, and Eric's blog, all that stuff will be linked up in the show notes for sure. You can check it all out. Eric, when you were doing, I guess, the research and writing the book, was there anything that, I guess, tickled you or surprised you? You didn't think you would find what you uncovered?
Absolutely. Something that I think would be specifically interesting to your listeners and was in terms of leadership, because, you know, I like I said, I'm, you know, reading all these research papers and these books, and many times, you know, yeah, there are clear answers, but other times, you know, academic research can be as conflicted as anything else. So a problem I had stumbled upon was there was a lot of research on leadership, and a lot of it was conflicting. There were a lot of results that showed that leaders don't matter. That if you have a good, proactive group of really energized people who are good at what they do, then a figurehead is fine. That these people will self-organize and get things done. And then you found, and there's other papers which would say that leadership matters enormously. That, you know, a charismatic leader, we're all familiar with the big names, can unite people, create a great story that people can all relate to and agree on, and he can energize people to do awesome things. And I was just like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to leave the leadership box unchecked because people can't agree. And then I came across some research by Gotham Mukunda at Harvard Business School, and he had actually resolved this dilemma and addressed the very question I've been curious about, because I'm like, do leaders matter? Do leaders not matter? And what he found was that the reason the research was so conflicted was because there are actually two types of leaders. There are filtered leaders and unfiltered leaders. And basically what that means is when you look at, say, like the CEO of GE, well, anybody who makes it to the CEO position at GE is going to have been heavily vetted. They are going to have climbed the ladder. They're going to have been, they're going to have the usual credentials. They're going to have, you know, had been promoted. They're going to have had multiple bosses. They're going to have been scrutinized left and right. And so what does that mean? That means that through that vetting process, let's say the final five people, you know, the men and women who had run the gauntlet, they're basically going to be indistinguishable because they've gone through this process. They've checked those boxes. They're probably going to make very similar decisions because they've all gone through this process. And those are filtered leaders. And so when you evaluate those people and you say, oh, we picked candidate number one instead of candidate number five, you're not going to see a huge distinction because they all went through the same vetting process. So in that sense, it doesn't matter as much because they're very similar. On the other hand, you have unfiltered leaders. So what happens with entrepreneurs where there was no filtration process? Somebody decided, I'm going to do this and I don't care and I'm going to do it on my own. What happens when the president of the United States steps down or, God forbid, is assassinated or anything like that? This is not the person that this guy probably got picked because he could bring the votes in Mississippi. So you're getting somebody who didn't go through the standard vetting process. And so those leaders, the unfiltered leaders, are enormously transformative. Now, granted, sometimes they're transformative in bad ways and they don't have the experience they need. They haven't checked all the boxes. And so they can do things that aren't very smart and don't lead to good things. On the other hand, if you look, for instance, one of Gotham's favorite examples is the election of Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln was elected by a wild collection of, you know, a perfect storm of events. And he created enormous change, the ending of slavery in the United States. So the leaders who are filtered tend to be very similar and not create big changes. The leaders who are unfiltered create enormous changes. Sometimes they're not so good. Sometimes they're fantastic. And it's just really valuable to sort of understand, you know, where are you coming from? Are you more of a filtered leader or an unfiltered leader? And to understand the organizations that you're involved in, what do they need at that point? If things are going great, if things are running smoothly, hey, you want a filtered leader. The system is good. Don't mess with it. On the other hand, if you're in an industry that is experiencing a lot of problems, that is just headed downward, that needs change, you don't want a filtered leader because they're going to be playing by the old rules, the rules that got you in this difficult situation to begin with. You want an unfiltered leader who's going to come in there, shake things up, hopefully for the better, and might be able to fix what's broken.
That is so relevant to my experience, both as a school leader, literally in a school, and then starting this platform as well. So I'm going to leave it at that because probably my lawyers would tell me that, even though I don't have lawyers. But that was super, super interesting, and thank you for sharing that. You talk, Eric, about how to be awesome at life, right? That's part of what you say on blog. So what advice would you have for the listeners who are interested in being awesome at life?
I mean, one of the critical things, there's all kinds of things and I've written about lots of different, you know, subjects, sometimes very serious things like meaning in life. Other times I interviewed my friend Chris, who was a former lead international hostage negotiator for the FBI, and I asked him the best tips he would give for lowering his cable bill. So it ranges all over. But in terms of being awesome at life, you know, one thing we all want is to be happy. And a key thing there is just gratitude. You know, is we tend to take things for granted. And if you look at so much of the research, I believe it was Sonia Lubomirsky, who's one of the leading researchers in terms of happiness, just said that, you know, when we feel gratitude, you know, it's almost impossible to feel bad when we're thankful for what we have. And there are very simple exercises. One was one by Martin Seligman at University of Pennsylvania that just before you go to bed at night, have a pad and a pen next to your bed, write down three good things that happened to you that day that you're thankful for. And when people do that after some weeks or maybe a couple months, they start to feel happier. Along those same lines, the tactical nuke of happiness that another study that Martin Seligman did is the gratitude visit, which is just sitting down, write a letter to someone who has done something really wonderful for you that you really appreciate, and then call the person, set a time to get together, do not tell them your intentions, and then face-to-face read them that letter. And that and I will also say bring tissues, because they're probably going to cry and you're probably going to cry. And this is something that makes people happier for months. Mm-hmm. And the great thing about the gratitude visit is that it makes two people happy. So, you know, I think in terms of living an awesome life, there's not much that's more important than happiness. And there are very simple, scientifically validated ways that, that we can be happier and thereby be awesome at life.
Yeah, and I talk a lot about gratitude on the podcast and the blog. Listeners, if you're new or you just missed an episode here or there, episode 90, I talked about developing an attitude of gratitude. And we discussed the gratitude journal, awesome jar, and all these other things. Awesome jar, I stole, Eric, from Tim Ferriss. So, you know, you might have heard of that. But gratitude's so important. And yeah, you talk about gratitude journal. I like that letter thing. I didn't want to leave my school, right? But Miriam got this awesome job opportunity, which is bringing us out of the country. So I've been floating around like, how do I thank people for their service and the welcoming environment they created for me, and I guess the impact they had on kids. And I'm wondering, you know, maybe doing that, right? Writing letters to the people I developed the closest relationships to and know the best, and just say, you know, thank you for X, Y, and Z, and get super specific. I'll have to buy a lot of Kleenex for that one, but I'm kicking that around for sure.
Absolutely. And if people don't have the time for tons of gratitude visits, another fantastic author and former Harvard researcher, Sean Anker, an excellent book he wrote, The Happiness Advantage. He shows research that just, you know, when you get in the office every day, before you do anything else, just sit down and send somebody an email or a text message to thank them for something they did for you recently. Something as simple as that can make you happier and can improve the rest of your day. And once again, it's wonderful because you're actually spreading the happiness virus. The other person, I mean, I think we all know that when, you know, we all sometimes feel unappreciated or feel like we went out of our way and somebody didn't really appreciate it. To get that thank you is really powerful as well. So a quick happiness boost, you know, takes no time at all, is just to send somebody a thank you text or email when you start your day, and it can make a big difference.
Eric, what's one class that you would add to our schools that's not currently taught that you know of?
I would definitely say economics, not in the sense of, you know, money or, you know, macroeconomics, but, you know, I think economics is a really valuable lens, not the only lens, but a very valuable lens through which to look at the world, which I think a lot of people never get exposed to, or they only get exposed to, you know, in college or graduate school. And to be able to understand opportunity cost, I think, is critical to understand, you know, your choices and the trade-offs, you know, is really important to understand the value of, to understand value, not just in terms of dollars, but in terms of money, time, resources. I think it's a very valuable lens to look at the world. And it's a, you know, it's very practical in terms of understanding money and finances and stuff like that. So it would fit in with a curriculum. But in terms of being able to understand the world better, I think it's a very, very valuable system of thinking that a lot of people never get exposed to, or get exposed to perhaps too late to use it for crafting very good decisions when you're young.
What do you do for fun, Eric?
I read a lot.
A little bit, yeah.
And, you know, it's a bit of a cliche to say you enjoy your job, but I mean, I get to read interesting stuff and I get to talk to really, really smart, accomplished people. So, I mean, what I do is, you know, every day is absolutely thrilling. But beyond that, you know, I've always been a fan of movies. I'm definitely a fan of good TV. And I love spending time with my girlfriend. So I'm lucky in that, you know, a lot of what I enjoy is what I do for a living. But definitely, I also take time out to read books that have no value whatsoever toward the blog or towards future writing. And love good movies and TV, and love spending time with my girlfriend.
So movies and TV, Eric, I have a 65-inch Samsung 4K TV. I don't know. Would you like to buy it?
I have one myself, and it's amazing. 4K is amazing. It is. But sometimes I don't even think it's a TV. Sometimes it's just a window to another world. It's so crystal clear.
Eric, if you could be automatically good at something, what would it be?
I'd have to say connecting with people. I think that's something, you know, I spend a lot of my time buried in books, and I've read a lot of the research in terms of interpersonal relationships. And, you know, everybody's got a great story. Everybody's got, you know, some great stuff to share with you, you know, and I think I'm pretty good with people, but I just think it's an amazing ability to just be able to get to know someone, to be able to, you know, to learn from them, to share with them. It's just really, really wonderful to feel connected to others. So, you know, and that's not something, because there are many skills where, you know, I've through the research I've been lucky enough to pick up or at least get the gist of, and that's something you can improve, but you know, there is a little bit of serendipity and magic to it. So I figure if I want to pick something I can be instantly good at, it should be something that's I want to use my one genie wish wisely. There is a drop of magic there, and that would be very valuable.
Eric, I'm proud of you. You made it to the end of the podcast. And this question's really, the listeners love it. I ask it every podcast, and I would love to hear your answer, especially since you're, you know, coming from outside of our industry, but just because of how your mind works too, and the work that you produce, I think we'll get a really fantastic answer. But you're building a school from the ground up. You're not limited by budget or resources. Your only limitation, Eric, is your imagination. How would you build your dream school, and what would be your top three priorities?
I think my dream school would be a little less formal, would be a little less structured. I think it would be more focused on community. I think there would be a huge emphasis first on curiosity, on creating that level of interest, of just sparking, you know, a level of curiosity first and foremost, rather than, you know, requirements. So bringing forth curiosity, past that, having teachers who are good at their subject is nice, but I think I would look for people who were good storytellers, people who could communicate, people who were good storytellers and people who could communicate great enthusiasm. Because, you know, one subject that I came to very late was history. And because I always remember history being lists of dates, and that just wasn't very interesting, at least to somebody like me. And now that I read books on history, history is fascinating. History is nothing but stories. If you love, you know, movies, TV, books, if you love having your friend just recount an anecdote for you, you would love history. So I think it's about the way it's told. So if I could inspire curiosity and make kids curious before they step in the door, I think that would be a huge priority. And then, like I said, people who were teachers or professors who were good storytellers. So, you know, obviously being good at the subject matter is important, but, you know, being able to make it interesting and actionable, that would be key to me. And beyond that, I think, like I said, that emphasis on community, where if you look at what increases team morale, if you look at what increases, you know, helps families be better, there is, you know, not just requirements like be here at 9 a.m. There are shared values, shared stories, shared beliefs. Frankly, it's a cult. You know, it sounds funny to say that, but it's like, you know, families, companies with strong morale, you always have this unified story, this unified beliefs. You know, cults generally a bad thing, but there's but if you can get people to unite like that, then we have something to learn. You know, in the book, when I'm talking about ethics, the first place I go to is I look at gang members and prison inmates. Because if we're going to talk about honesty and we're going to talk about trust, let's look at the people who have the absolute least, and we can learn some lessons there. So I think a community, you know, bordering on a cult, where there's shared values, shared beliefs, people feel they're a part of something. They're not showing up out of obligation. They're showing up because they feel like they're connected. Those are things that I would aim for.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any actionable steps you'd like the listeners to take after listening, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
If they Google my name, Eric Barker, or Barking Up the Wrong Tree, they can find my blog. There's a search function on there. If there's any subjects you and I have discussed that they're specifically curious about, that will come up. And if they want to learn more about whether these maxims of life success that we've all heard so much about are true, then they should definitely check out my book, Barking Up the Wrong Tree. It's currently available for pre-order on Amazon, iTunes, Barnes & Noble, all the usual suspects. And I encourage them to do that. And if they want, they can join my mailing list. It's one email a week, and it gives the latest that I've found in looking at the scientific studies and talking to the experts about what makes for an awesome life.
Better leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life's 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it, which I used to believe, but I'll have to see if it's in Eric's book. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Eric. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Eric in the search bar, and the show notes page will pop up. You'll get to highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Eric, thanks again for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you.
Better leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge 10 bucks a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.